thing that when I was leading up to the lecture last week, I've been building this under false pretense in a certain way, because I seem to be suggesting I'm going to be coming out attacking Hans Hofer, going against him. And actually, you'll see that isn't true, although there are points that I do differ with in the way the argument's usually presented. The main point, as you'll see in a lecture that perhaps is somewhat different from what you previously encountered about argumentation of it, I tend to have my own way of looking at it that might be a way of interpreting the argument, but it's probably a bit different from what you're used to. I'd be interested, those of you who've taken the Stefan Kinsella's course or read other things, how what I'm saying differs or is the same as what you've heard or read elsewhere. Now, I think the main reason that the way I look at argumentation ethics and presenting argumentation ethics is different from what you might have been used to in other presentations is that very often libertarians who are interested in argumentation ethics will just consider or read material by Hans Hofer or by Frank Van Dunn or other libertarians possibly written on this. And they tend to study argumentation ethics separately as if it just concerns the libertarian writers. Usually it isn't considered together with other approaches to ethics that are similar. And what I think is that argumentation ethics can be very usefully studied if it's considered together with the contractualist view we've been considering. Remember, in the lecture the last time, I was discussing some attempts to say that morality in some way rests on what people would agree to and what rules people would agree to under various conditions. First, of course, we have this as a feature of Rawls's theory. It has a somewhat limited role where people in the original position are trying to come up with rules, and Rawls takes what they would agree to in the original position, giving the principle of justice. Then we saw David Gautier wants to extend that to all morality, and also Thomas Scanlon, as we were, he wants to have a contractual basis for all morality involves other people. And actually, as you will see, the argumentation ethics is closest to Scanlon's uses of the ones we talked about. Now, what Hans Hofer and Frank Van Dunn are trying to do is that they're trying to adapt to libertarian use a well-established way of doing ethics. So it isn't that they've come up with some just theory just on their own that should just be studied by itself, but they're taking a theory that's already established. Other philosophies, you'll see in a moment, have worked on argumentation ethics, and they're saying we can use this to come to libertarian conclusions. So I think it's very important, if we're going to understand this theory properly, to see what this tradition of argumentation ethics is that they're trying to develop in a libertarian way. Now, Hans Hofer was a student of Jürgen Habermas, who was a professor at the University of Frankfurt, and I think he later taught in Berlin. He's probably the most famous current German philosopher. And he was the one who really pioneered in developing argumentation ethics. Hans has a book, Theory of Communicative Action, where he goes into, he has all sorts of books. And there was another philosopher who was a colleague of his, a friend of his, Carl Otto Appel, who was slightly older than Habermas, who was more strictly interested in theoretical philosophy. Habermas kind of spread all over. He's written on metaphysics somewhat, theory of knowledge, but he's made more a social philosopher. Carl Otto Appel is more interested in metaphysics and epistemology. So they developed argumentation ethics, sometimes called discourse ethics. And this is the tradition Hans Hoppe's coming out of, and got this directly from Habermas. He was, I think, he told me Habermas thought very highly of him. He was one of Habermas' star students, but then when his political views became moving libertarian direction, they weren't as close as they were before. Now, as I mentioned, Habermas in particular, I think also Appel, although he's not political, are definitely not libertarian. In fact, Habermas began as a Marxist, and he was associated with the Frankfurt School. This was a group that was founded after World War I. It included Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, and they're very influential if you study 20th century Marxism. They're an extremely influential group. And Habermas, at the start of his career, was a Marxist. He's become somewhat less radical than he used to be as he's gotten older, but he's still very much left of center, not a libertarian. In fact, when he just won an interesting, at least I think interesting gossip item. When he got started, he wrote an influential attack on Martin Heidegger, who was probably the most influential 20th century German philosopher. Remember, Heidegger was at one time, had been a member of the Nazi Party, although there's a lot of dispute as to what exactly his relations were with the Nazis. And Habermas wrote an attack on him because of his Nazi association. And the gossip item is Heidegger was very angry about this. He really didn't like Habermas very much. So he took it very personally. And of course, Heidegger was still around through the early 1970s. So he didn't think very highly of Habermas. Now, what the discourse ethics or argumentation ethics as Habermas and Carl Otto Appel developed it, it's an attempt to discover rules of conduct toward one another that people would reasonably accept. So imagining that people were, imagine people trying to get together and say, well, what are the rules of morality that affect morality, the rules that govern relations among people. People are trying to agree on what are the rules that are reasonable to accept. As you'll see, as you remember, if you come to my lecture last week or seen on the video, this is very similar to Thomas Stanley, who talked about rules that people couldn't reasonably reject. So this is just similar to rules people would reasonably accept. So now, here's where I think it's important to avoid what I consider a fundamental mistake about discourse or argumentation ethics. And, this is a mistake I think sometimes people fall into, who I've seen in various literature and discussions of argumentation ethics, that argumentation ethics is not an attempt to show that certain moral judgments or requirements of logic. Of course, you're using reasoning and trying to figure out what the rules people would reasonably accept are. But the claim that Habermas and Appel is not that if you reject argumentation ethics or if you don't accept some particular conclusion, then you're guilty of some kind of logical contradiction. It's just that you're not, you're accepting the rule that if you don't accept it, they're saying, well, you wouldn't be accepting what people reasonably should accept. But reasonably does not mean just required by the laws of logic. That, of course, raises the issue of meaning, well, what do we mean by, what are we talking about when we talk about reasonable? Arguably, it would be reasonable to accept if we don't have in mind just the laws of logic. What are we talking about? Well, there are various types of reason, various ways we can think about reason. We've discussed, gone over this in some of the other lectures. It's very important to understand what we mean here. Now, the first type is the one I just mentioned that I said orientation tables isn't considered. This is logical consistency. So here, if you someone violated a logical law, say you affirm both sides of a contradiction, then you're going against reason in this sense. You're doing something that's logically, you're saying something that's logically inconsistent. But unless you do that, you're not going against reason in this sense. Now, suppose, an odd example, suppose somebody does something very much against his interest, let's say a person just walks into moving traffic, and we're not assuming the person wants to commit suicide, he just steps off and says, well, you know, I want to get to the other side, okay, dodge all the cars. That would be a very foolish thing to do, I think we could say. But it isn't irrational in this first sense, unless you could show it's violating some logical law. And it's a good way to get yourself killed if you do that, if you just walk into moving traffic. But you're not what would be the logical law if you're violating by doing that. So in this way of thinking about reason, it isn't irrational. Now, the great 18th century philosopher David Hume wrote about this use of reason. He was very famously skeptical about the possibility of showing that actions were irrational in this logical sense. I give a famous quotation, where he said, it's not contrary to reason to prefer the destruction of the whole world to the scratching of my finger. So imagine, suppose you have a choice, either if your finger is itching, so you say, well, you can relieve your finger from itching, or the whole world would be destroyed. Well, I mean, it would be extraordinarily strange to say that your finger scratching is more important than destruction of the whole world, but according to Hume, you wouldn't be contradicting yourself if you preferred scratching your finger than destruction of the whole world. And he said, it's not contrary to reason for me to choose my total ruin to prevent the least even if they're in the inner person, totally, I can't see the rest because it's being blocked with something like totally unrelated to me. So, now of course, he sounds like he's very anti-Randian there because, of course, Rand says it is required by reason to give preference to ourselves. But that isn't the way he's using reason, he just means a strict violation of the law of logic. He says goes on to say it's not contrary to reason to prefer his lesser good to his greater good. This sounds, again, extremely odd, but all it means is that you're not violating some logical law if you do that. So he's saying that is, so Hume was very skeptical because of the place of reason and ethics. He said, well, look, you're not, whatever you do, you're, whatever actions you do, you aren't violating the laws of logic. Then he tended to rule out a place for reason in ethics, but there are other sense of reason than just strict logical contradiction that need to be considered. Now, as I say, reason can mean something other than logical consistency. But one very important meaning reasons, like all, usually called instrumental reason, is deals with whether your means will achieve your end. It's like, given that I want X, I should do Y. So given I want to cross the street and be alive after I've done so, it would not be a good means to that end to go into moving traffic. So I wouldn't be violating laws of logic if I just went in front of a car. But it certainly wouldn't be a good means of getting what I want. And this is the basic meaning when Mises talks about ethics. This is what he has in this sense of reason, is what he has in mind. Because given the ends people have, or most people have, people want peace and prosperity, then we should establish a free market. This is the instrumental sense of reason. Given that we have these ends, this is what we should do. Now, you remember David Gautier, whom we were talking about a lot the last time, he also has instrumental view of reason. He's saying, remember, he considers morality to be certain dispositions we have to cooperate in prison's dilemma. He says, well, suppose I see there's a chance I could steal something and get away with it, because maybe the store clerk isn't looking, I'm just taking get away with it. Most people are brought up, so they just don't consider doing that. It wouldn't occur to them in going to the store. They just case the store and figure out how you might steal things. We have disposition not to do that. And we said, well, we ask questions, is it rational that you were brought up this way to have these dispositions? And when he said, is it rational, I mean, will this be in our interest to have them? Will we, if we have these dispositions, will this be in our interest? Of course, he said, it will be. So what he means by this is, is it rational, the instrumental reason, will this enable us to get what we want? He said, yes, it will, because we'll be able to reach the cooperative solution in various prisoners' dilemmas. So you see, he's using this sense of instrumental reason. Now, we can have yet another sense of reason. So far I've talked about the logical consistency, which is the reason not violating the laws of logic. Well, as I said, something like, I am both a man and not a man, I'd be violating the law of logic. So I think that's one reason. And then given example of instrumental reason, or given whatever ends I have, I say, how can I realize that and achieve those ends? What's a good way of achieving those ends? Now we can get another sense of reason, which is going somewhat beyond instrumental rationality. Here, the claim is that reason can establish the nature of good life for each person. So Aristotle can be taken this way, although sometimes people argue about exactly how Aristotle's ethics is understood. But we can have one way of understanding Aristotle's paper, like he was saying, we can establish by reason what the end of a human life is, what is the best life. So it isn't in this way that you're just saying, Aristotle's saying, well, take whatever end you want, and ethics is just telling you how to achieve that. He's saying there's a way of figuring out what the best life for human beings is. But he isn't saying that it's just deducible from just by the laws of logic itself that this is the best life. It's using certain premises that he has to establish that. So it isn't claiming that you're violating logical consistency if you just don't live in that way. It's just saying you're going against reason in a kind of extended way. Reason and establish what the good life is. Ayn Rand is also, and I interpret her, can be taken as similar to Aristotle, that she thought that the values depend, for a person, the values depend on each person taking his own life as a standard of value. She said if you don't choose to live, then she didn't think you could have values at all. So once you have a basic choice to live, then other values are instrumental to that. How can I live? How can I survive or survive as a rational being? So things that are instrumental, but your choice to survive, survival is not just an optional choice. It's just an optional, it's one you must choose if you're going to have values at all. Now, I want to now distinguish another sense of reasoning. Talk about so far we have logical consistency, then we have gone on from logical consistency to instrumental reasoning. How can you best achieve your ends, whatever the ends are, then you extend it that way. Well, some people say that you can establish what the best life is for each person. Aristotle said that. But argumentation ethics use a different sense of reason from the ones we've discussed so far. Here the issue is, what would it be reasonable for people to agree on under the requirement that they agree on rules that apply to everyone equally? So we have to come up with saying, what would it be reasonable for people to agree on, but these rules will apply to everyone equally. This is one point, if you've read the Hot Topic, you've got the following Habermas very consistent on it. You'll find this also been done. The rules must be universalizable. You wouldn't come up with rules that say, I get all the money and everyone else has to be my slave. We have to have rules that apply to everyone equally. Now, you remember from the last lecture when we talked about Thomas Scanlon, this is very much like what Scanlon was saying. Scanlon was saying he's trying to establish rules we couldn't reasonably reject. And these rules, why are we trying to find these rules? Because this is one way we express our respect for other people. So you see what the basic difference is between the instrumental reason in finding a good life for yourself and this kind of reason. When we talk about instrumental reason, how do I achieve my ends, whatever my ends are? And we talk about the good life, or what is the good life for me? But here the issue is interpersonal, saying each of us has respect for everyone else, so what rules could we agree on, given we're trying to come up with universal rules that apply to everyone? It's actually communicated rationality. That's exactly right. That's the term Habermas uses for what we're talking about. So the basic idea here, we're talking about the sense of reason, we're trying to come up with rules among the people who agree on that express their respect for one another, their universal idol. It comes from the second version of Kant's categorical imperative. Remember, Kant has several different versions of categorical imperative. But the first one is just the universalizability requirement. The second version of categorical imperative says we have to treat every person as an end in himself, not only as a means. We're treating everyone as someone worthy of respect. So how do we do this? How do we treat everyone as worthy of respect? Well, argumentation ethics is we do this by reasoning together about the norms that should apply in our relations with each other. So instead of trying to each figure out for ourselves what are the appropriate moral norms, we get, we imagine ourselves getting together, so we're kind of in, we're giving the law of reason to ourselves, and so this is, in this community, this is the way we're showing respect for each other by getting ourselves involved in this process of giving ourselves laws and coming up with what are the rules we should follow. We should be clear, argumentation ethics only applies to the part of morality that concerns our relations with other people. So it doesn't apply, and this is one thing Habermas is very clear, emphasized a lot, it doesn't apply to ethical issues that just concern individuals. Say, Aristotle, as I mentioned, was asking, how can I lead a good life? So that's a question that concerns the individual. Part of that will, of course, involve relations with other people, have friends, family, or the sangha, the city for Aristotle. But some of ethics concerns just development of our own character. So here, orientation ethics isn't concerned with just ethical issues that just involve individuals. We're just talking about orientation ethics rules that concern individuals who are related to one, to, or involved in relations with one another in society. We're trying to come up with social and political rules. This is all that orientation ethics covers. So now here again, and we covered some of this before, but I just want to make sure we have this nailed down to the two important points. Orientation ethics is not trying to answer the what's in it for me question. Remember, I gave you, it's one of my favorite passages in one of the novels by P.G. Woodhouse. There's a character who says to Jeeves, he says, Butler knows, he's really smart, Butler knows everything. He said, whenever anything comes up, I always ask myself one question, what's in it for me? So this is not what argumentation ethics is trying to answer. So it isn't an attempt to argue that it's in our self-interest to observe the rules it comes up with. It's a different approach to morality. Sometimes people have objected to orientation ethics. I've heard this objection. They say, well, suppose you come up with the rules that people will agree to by argument, then there's still the question, what is my motivation to accept these rules? Why should I, or orientation ethics say we should be such a, why should I actually do that? And if sometimes the objection is, well, all judgments of practical reason, judgments that we talk about what we should do, have to involve some appeal to our interest. They have to say, well, if you should follow this rule because this will enable you to achieve such and such, where that's something you want to achieve, that isn't the way orientation ethics works. It isn't trying to say that morality is in your interest. It's a different way of looking at reason things, where we each have respect for other people and these the rules we come up with. It's not trying to explain morality in terms of self-interest. And the second point is that argumentation ethics isn't an attempt to say that you're violating the laws of logic if you violate these rules. I mentioned this before, but the reason I'm saying that is we'll see later this point has led to trouble, because I think some people interpret certain parts of argumentation ethics, especially as developed by Hans Hoppe. So you're pretty close to violating the law of logic if you reject certain of its rules. And I'm not sure what this is part of, the famous controversial part, I'm not sure whether Hoppe himself takes it this way, but I think it is a wrong way of looking at it. So that's the part where I'm most apprehensive that I'll get into trouble, but we haven't gotten to that yet. Now, so supposing then we have this idea that we're trying to show respect for one another by coming up with rules of morality, rules that apply to interpersonal relations, by coming up with getting together and agreeing on them in common that rules have to be universalizable. How do we do this? How do we come up with the rules? It's a nice idea, but how do we get these rules? And so Habermas and Apple have an interesting idea on how to find out what rules people would agree on in these conditions. They say, doesn't the process of trying to find out what these rules are, imagine all these people getting together and trying to agree on these rules for universalizing, couldn't we get a clue on what the rules we should come up with by saying, well, let's consider this process of getting together and see what would we do in that process? How would we try to get together? What's involved in argumentation? So that'll give us some way of coming up with the rules for society. Let's say, well, what are the rules for argumentation under these conditions? And if we think about those rules, then we'll be able to get the general rules of morality. And this is what they mean by discursive argumentation ethics. Now, here's, I think, you know, I like to talk about mistakes a lot, because I think there are a lot of mistakes in this area. Now, here's what I think is one very serious mistake to avoid. When they're talking about your norms of argumentation, what they mean is argumentation for this particular purpose, that is, to decide on what the universalizable rules are. They're saying, if you're trying to argue in this way, then you have to follow these particular rules. Now, the mistake to avoid is, it doesn't cover every use of argumentation for communication, for example, trying to deceive somebody. And Danny Sanchez sent me a very interesting point he made. I think he mentioned, he raised it in Stefan himself, but imagine a lion talking to someone, and the lion says, well, the only reason I'm arguing with you is that I don't want to eat you, I don't think you're too stringy, I don't feel like eating you. So, couldn't you say, well, if the lion is talking back, how could you say the lion has the principles of ethics that you can have just from this communication between the lion and man? The lion just has no interest in man at all in respect to this. How could you say that there is some sort of ethical rules that are implied in the situation where they're talking to the lion, not just talking to them just for adventitious reasons, because he wants to meet him. So we have to understand argumentation ethics isn't designed to cover cases like that where they're just looking at people as instruments to our goals. We're predicated on that we're in this exchange together to try to come up with the rules. So this is a very interesting point. It shows, I think, that if you try to extend this broadly, say, well, any argument at all involves accepting certain norms, there are counterexamples to that. But argumentation ethics isn't intended for every kind of use of language. It's only this particular type of exchange that we're trying to come up with rules in common. baseline of respecting each other that the norms are supposed to apply. I should just say, incidentally, it appears that Danny isn't a Wittgensteinian on this thing. I remember the famous passage in Philosophical Investigation where Wittgenstein says, if a lion could talk, we couldn't understand him. I gather Danny doesn't accept that, at least for the purpose of the story. He doesn't accept that. Now, one objection that people sometimes advance against orientation ethics is that the norms it comes up with apply only to the process of argument itself. For example, suppose you say, well, what, say, we're arguing with people trying to come up with these common rules. Well, one rule we would probably come up with is that while we're arguing, each person should have be able to use his own body if he wants. It would be hard to get an good argument going, but exchange if, say, one person could just come over and just appropriate somebody else's body, prevent him from talking. That wouldn't be a good way to come up with universal rules based on respecting one another. So, supposing we would have to recognize during the process of argument that we'd have to recognize everyone as a self-owner when we're arguing. So then sometimes one has the objection, well, why should this apply once you stop arguing? This is to say, well, we couldn't have an argument under the conditions, say, where some people just appropriate other people's bodies and prevent them from talking. That wouldn't be a good way to come up with universalizable rules everyone would accept. But why doesn't that just give you rules just for the process of argument? But you see, this objection really misconceives what orientation ethics is trying to do. Because the whole point is that the norms of argument are giving you a clue or suggestion to what the general norm should be. So if something comes up as a rule of the process of argument, this is the way you're trying to determine what the rule, general rules of social interaction are. So if you're saying, well, why should I go ahead and follow those rules outside of this argumentative context, that's misconceiving the whole process. That's really going back to the instrumentalist view, saying, well, why should I follow these rules that we come up with within the process of argument? Why do we apply outside? The whole point is that thinking about what's involved in the process of argument is, according to these philosophies, the way we come up with the rules for general social interaction. So that's why this argument doesn't apply. Again, it's not that you're logically inconsistent, if you say, well, this applies to argument, but why should it apply outside the argument? It's just the whole point of being involved in the argument is trying to come up with these general rules, and the idea of orientation of it is you use what we would accept in the process of arriving in agreement as a way of finding out or determining what the general rules are. So somebody could say, well, I don't accept that, or I don't think we should do that, and that's the whole basis of the way orientation of it proceeds. Now, what Hans Hoppe and Franklin Dunn have tried to do, and this I think is the innovation from the way orientation has been developed by Habermas and Van Dunn. They suggest that what these norms we would agree on, then we're trying to establish universalizable rules based on respect for one another. They suggest we would come up with libertarian conclusions. For example, wouldn't people accept the rule that everyone was a self-owner. This seems to be a very good point, very important point they brought up. Suppose somebody suggested that one group of people should enslave others. Let's say somebody said, well, we should have a superior master race, should enslave people who were racially inferior. That wouldn't win agreement. Obviously, people who would be enslaved wouldn't be very apt to agree that they should be enslaved. It wouldn't be a universalizable rule. So it's very plausible that in this situation where we're trying to come up with these universalizable rules, that we would accept that each person is a self-owner, each person owns himself or herself. So I think this is, I think, a very important point that Topp and Van Dunne made a real contribution to argumentation ethics. Now we're going to get into, stay with me so far, now we're going to get into the somewhat controversial part, or a bit critical of certain ways that the argumentation ethics has been taken. As I say, I'm not sure the extent to which Hopper himself takes them this way. I think Van Dunne doesn't take it in the way I'm suggesting is wrong, but this is something people can take and step on, of course, can perhaps have something to contribute. Now, to understand the next argument, we have to grasp the notion of a pragmatic paradox, or sometimes called a performative contradiction. I think performative contradiction is the term that's more generally used by Topp, and you're probably more familiar with. Now, this is a performative contradiction is different from a logical contradiction. For example, that logical contradiction would be Hans Hermann Hoppe is both German and not German. That would violate the law of non-contradiction. So that's a logical contradiction. A performer's contradiction is different. A performer's contradiction is a statement that's false if you say it. So the very fact that you make a certain statement shows that it's false. For example, suppose I say I'm totally unconscious. I just said I'm totally unconscious. Well, I could say I'm totally unconscious only if I were conscious, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to say anything. If I were unconscious, I'm not able to speak. So my saying I'm totally unconscious shows that the statement is false. So you see, it's from contradiction is a statement that's false if you say it. Now, a performative contradiction doesn't have to be logically self-contradictory. So if we consider the example I just given, I say I'm totally unconscious. Well, that could be the case. I mean, suppose somebody, it could be the case that I'm totally unconscious. So somebody just came over, didn't like my lecture, hit me over the head with a hammer. I'd be totally unconscious. So it would be true that I'm totally unconscious. So it's not a logical contradiction that I'm totally unconscious. But the form of contradiction is just if I say I'm totally unconscious, my saying that shows that I'm not when I'm saying that totally unconscious. Now comes the trouble. The rest is, as they say, we've led up to this. This is as far as Tennyson says, a far off event to which the whole creation moves. This is where I'm going to get into trouble. I want to raise the question, is it a performative contradiction if you deny that you own yourself? Suppose you say, I don't own myself. well, how to perform a contradiction, it would have to be the case that my saying I don't own myself, I can only say that if I do own myself. So that would be what the performing contradiction would be, if it is a performing contradiction. The condition for my saying I don't own myself is that I do own myself. So the question is, well, what is supposed to be the contradiction, and why is it a performing contradiction? Well, the contention is that in order to say something, including I don't own myself, I have to have control over my own body. So you can't say anything unless you control your own body. But if you say I don't own myself, what I'm saying is I don't have control over my body. So I could only say I don't have control over my own body if I did have control over my own body. So that's the reason we sometimes claim that saying I don't own myself is a performed contradiction. You see how the argument's supposed to go. It's saying, well, saying I own myself is saying I have control over my own body. But if I say I don't own myself, I'm saying I don't have control of my own body, but I can only say that if, in fact, I do have control over my own body. So that's the claim that's a performative contradiction. Now, there's some people who have objected to that. They say, well, maybe you only need part of your body in order to speak, but you only have to have control over your own mouth, so you're not guilty of a performative contradiction unless you deny that you own any part of yourself. So I must say I consider that kind of a silly point. You mentioned mouths that are just talking by themselves, not taking the rest of the person's body. But what I want to try to show is both the original claim is a performative contradiction, that detached from the mouth. Well, I mean, they're detachable false teeth, I suppose. Detachable mouths or something else. It reminds me, there's a comedian, I think his name is Stephen Wright, I'm not sure about it. He says, you can tell what someone is thinking a lot by looking at his face, especially at the mouth part of the face. So that was supposed to be a joke. You can laugh. Okay, so this objection is, well, maybe you don't need control of your entire body to speak. You only need control of certain parts of the body. So it's not you're not involved in certain contradiction unless you deny that you own any part of yourself. So what I want to say is both this original claim and this objection rest on the same mistake. Now, we have to ask, well, let's consider the statement, I own myself. Now, what it seems to me, this is a somewhat deceptive in its form. What I mean by that is that I own myself is a deceptive form. It appears to be a descriptive statement, something that states a fact, like, I am an old man. That would be a true descriptive statement of me. And I'm an old man, so it seems like I own myself in a statement like that. We have a question here. Let me just look at this. Yes, now, Leslie, the way I'm going, it's a good question, but I'll be just covering it. Now, what seems to me the case is that the statement, I own myself, really isn't descriptive. It's really a covered ought statement. It's something saying something like, I ought to be the person who gets to decide what to do things with my body, what to do various actions with my body, not other people. So if you tell me where I have to live, you're violating my self-ownership. I should be the one to decide questions like that. So something like, I have the right to decide what to do with my body, not you or anybody else. Or say, I ought to be the person. See, it's not a descriptive thing of saying, it ought to be the case that each person has jurisdiction over his or her own body. So it's not a descriptive statement, it's an ought statement. Now, if you keep this in mind, I think we'll see what's wrong with the claim that if you deny you own yourself, you fall into a performative contradiction. Now, one hand, suppose somebody said, I don't own myself. Well, what is he saying? Remember, we have to bear in mind what we're supposed to keep in mind that the self-ownership principle is an ought statement. So if someone says, I don't own myself, what he's saying is, it's not the case that I ought to be the person who decides what to do with my body. So saying, it's somebody else who should do it. John points out, St. Paul has made this statement. Well, that's very interesting. That's an interesting point. I mean, like I say, someone could certainly say, really, God has jurisdiction, should be the one who decides what to do with my body. That certainly, somebody could certainly hold such a view. So then, if you bear this in mind, you say, well, somebody says, I don't own myself, saying, I am not the one who should decide what to do with my body. Then if you say to this person, but look, you're saying, I don't own myself, you haven't pointed to contradiction. You see, you would have a contradiction if I own myself as something like, I'm in control of my body, and I say, I don't own myself, so I'm saying, I'm not in control of my body. And you would say to the person, look, at least you're in control of your body enough to be able to speak, so you're involving some sort of contradiction. But here, if what you mean is, I don't have the right, I shouldn't, to decide what to do with my body, then the fact that you're speaking doesn't appear to be a contradiction. If you say, it's not the case that I ought to be the person who decides what to do with my body, this is consistent with the fact that you're deciding what to do with your body. You're just saying it ought not to be the case that I have one who decides. In fact, I'm doing this. Now, why might you think that there was a contradiction here? I said that there wasn't countries, but maybe you think there is one. Here I think we get to really the essence of the matter. You might think that if I'm doing something, this implies that I have a right to do something. So here you say, well, I'm speaking, so this implies I have a right to speak. So if I say, I don't have a right over my own body, then I'm involved in contradiction with that. I'm saying, I don't have a right over my own body, but I have the right to speak, so isn't that a contradiction? But you don't, this is involves a false step, because you're doing something doesn't, I think, imply that you think you have a right to do it. In a case, suppose there's a thief steals your wallet, so you're walking down the street, pickpocket, sees your wallet, and that pocket just runs away with it. He isn't claiming that he's the owner of it, he has a right to take your wallet. You could imagine a case where he does make such claims, he thinks it's really his wallet, but we don't have to think that, we could just say, just a man and say, sure, it's your wallet, but I stole it. So here you're doing something doesn't buy you think you have a right to do it. So that's what I think is the problem with saying, if you say I don't own myself, why I think this doesn't involve any preferring contradiction, because you're not claiming, what you're really saying is you own yourself and say, I have the right to decide what to do with my own body. So merely by speaking, I'm not claiming that I have such a right, I'm not involved in contradiction. I think it's an interesting historical point to look at history more philosophy. There was an English philosopher, William Wollaston, who was in 1659, 1754, was a deist, and he had an argument that, to my mind, is very like this preferring contradiction argument. He said that all immorality rests on lies. So somehow if you do something wrong, you're lying. Lying isn't just one wrong thing you can do. It underlies all immorality. He said, well, for example, a thief has made the false claim, this property is mine. David Wallace said, someone has stolen your wallet, he's saying, this is my wallet, but that's a false claim, but it's your wallet. But just what I think is guilty of the fallacy here, because the thief isn't saying, it's really, the wallet really ought to belong to me. Ethically required that I have the wallet. Sure, he wants the wallet. He's violating laws and morality. He could know that, except that he just wants to feel it. So this is, again, why I don't think there is a reformed contradiction saying you don't own yourself. And remember, if you're really following argumentation ethics, would you want there to be a reformed contradiction? Well, I don't think you really would, because if you say there's a preferring contradiction saying I don't own myself, then this doesn't involve argumentation with other people at all. It would just be something to just think out for yourself. But the whole point of argumentation ethics is to come up with rules that we would agree on, hopefully, as we want communication. But this argument is something that you could just carry out completely isolated, or just do anyway. Said that I don't own myself to be contradicting myself, you see. So I don't accept that. So that's the part of one of the things I'm liable for the death penalty. So now John said, someone is simultaneously asserting denying problems. Isn't that a perver- yes, that would be, but see, John, just what I'm saying is that if you spoke or imagined, you wouldn't be simultaneously asserting denying property rights, because you wouldn't, in speaking, be claiming you have a right to speak, you would just be speaking. Oh, I'm sorry, Jock, you caught me out. I made a mistake. It's 1724, not 1754. Thank you. Thanks very much for catching that. Yes, Matthew's right, 1724. Okay. So now, I've already got death penalty, now we're going, in case there's a reprieve, now we're going for even more trouble. Now, if you agree with me, even if I'm right that there isn't this performing contradiction, it still leaves intact that it wouldn't be reasonable for people to see the agreement on universal principles to reject self-ownership. So I think Frank Mangan is completely right that people would accept self-ownership principle. We wouldn't agree on principle. Some people should be the slaves of other people. Also, it seems to me reasonable to think that people might agree on a libertarian homesteading principle. But here's where I'm going to get into trouble again. I don't think this is the only logically possible principle. Remember, in argumentation ethics anyway, we're not trying to come up with rules that are logically necessary. We're just coming up with rules that are reasonable to accept. I've heard the argument made by some people Hoosier principle is the only one that's logically possible. Maybe I'm misunderstanding what they intended, but this doesn't seem to be right. Suppose you said, suppose somebody proposed a rule, the third person to own property acquires it. And that would be a quite silly rule to adopt. Why would we want to adopt a rule like that? But I don't see anything logically contradictory about it. Now you might say this wouldn't make property acquisition impossible. You could imagine a situation where a new user would always displace the previous user, then we couldn't have permanent property acquisition. But this isn't the rule I would mention. It's just the third person who uses the property acquires it, not the first user. Again, I don't certainly don't favor this principle, but I'm just saying the logic is possible. And we wouldn't even have to logically have to have any system of permanent acquisition of property, but also just having a little bit of tragedy that comes, that would be very bad for people not to establish private property, but it's not logically required. Now someone said, Hopper said, we could imagine a rule that no one would appropriate, but just the rule we're imagining is the third person to acquire it would get it. So I don't see how that would be different from what you were suggesting. Now, of course, I think the libertarian principle is the reasonable one to adopt. I don't think we should make claims that something is logically necessary. It isn't. We want to make sure the claims we make are justifiable. We don't go beyond what we can support by argument. So I think that brings us to the end of the lecture. So you see, I hope that I've already gotten myself into sufficient trouble, so I think we'll stop now and we can have an argument and objection. All that. And see, remember, if we're trying to establish certain rules that are logically necessary, then we're really not going in accord with the basic principle of argumentation ethics, which is one that people would reasonably agree on. You don't need other people if you can show something logically required. So see, I think it would really, taking it this way would go against the whole structure of argumentation ethics. Okay, so now people can let me have it. Now, this is the question, if you accept argumentation, do you necessarily disagree with voluntary slavery? At the most interesting point, well, I think you would in this way. Remember that what is the basis of argumentation ethics is that each person has respect for everyone else, each person accepting the orientation of the way to implement the second version of Kant's imperative, where we're each displaying respect for other people. So if you enslave someone, even with a consent, you're not really displaying respect for that person. You say, well, what if it's voluntary? What if the person wants to be a slave? Well, then the person is showing lack of self-respect. It's not only that you require respect to other people, it requires respect to yourself as well. So slavery, even if it's voluntary, would be kind of fundamentally going against the basis of orientation ethics, which is based on viewing each person as an enemy of himself or herself. Now, one question I've asked is, those of you taking the other course on it, was it claimed that it performed contradiction if you say I don't own myself, and if that was like what was supposed to be the argument for it. And how was that defended? Yes, if he's the one who defended it. Yeah. Let me see. John says, this is the exact same point. Once you start arguing, Kathy, admitting you have the right to do it. Well, see, this is exactly, we're focusing on just the point I'm thinking is not correct, that I think doing something doesn't involve logically require you to think you have a right to do what you do. This is my example of the thief who's taking something he's not and got the right to do it. That was why I gave that example. So I think now you might think, well, it wouldn't be reasonable in the sense if somebody would start talking about that you don't have a right to it. But here it isn't a strict contradiction to do something you don't have. You might think it's kind of hard to do, to keep doing what you think you don't have a right to, but I don't see anything really contradictory about it. That's what my example of a thief was trying to show. So if you took it the other way, you'd be adopting both these view of matter. Okay, we're going to have a rephrasing of the point. Now make sure when you're rephrasing, you're not just making the same claim in other words. Well, it's more that, John said, it's more that even though you're denying it, you're exercising it. What you're exercising is just, what you're doing is just speaking. You're not exercising your right to speak, you're just speaking. And just like the issue is, does doing something involves some sort of claim that you have a right to do what you're doing, and I'm not clear why you should think that, and why one should think that, you see. There's another charge. Why is it that you have to have a place in which you're right? I think that's certainly true, I mean, unless people don't float in the air, but again, you don't have to make the claim that you have a right to be wherever you're standing. I could, if I trespass, suppose I just go into your house and just start going there. And then John says, no, somebody has granted you that. No, I mean, you're any more than if you steal something, it doesn't suggest that someone has given you the right to steal a person thing, you could get it. You have the right, you're just doing it. Gentle, I'm just coming to your house, I'm trespassing. No one's given me the right to trespass. That's just what trespass means. I'm going there. Yes, that's right. It would be invasion. If what you're suggesting is by orientation, you're agreeing to accept certain, you're trying to come up with certain norms with other people, then you could just say, well, I'm just trying to come up with a certain norm based on respect for people. That would be perfectly all right. But just by saying, making a statement wouldn't involve that you're claiming a right. So I would say, yes, it would be one of the rules that results from one of the underlying rules that you would accept in trying to come up with rules and try to come up with rules that everyone would accept, universalized rules. What I'm questioning is just saying, well, it's just you're doing something in some kind of broader sense involves your claim you have a right to do it. And then just to kind of like throw in a funny story, there was a historian I used to know, a very strangest person I ever met in my life, even stranger than I am, which is saying a lot. And he once went to see one of his ex-wives, and there's no one home, so he just walked into her house, made himself a sandwich, and then left, and he was accused of stealing things from her. So in that case, Trevor wasn't claiming he had a right to do it, but he did it. Now, Jacques, it's not the only way of proving self-ownership. And what you think is the neat additional argument that this fulfilling contradiction one? Is that, well, I mean, I don't think it's just in the way it's stated it. I don't think it would be valid. Okay, when you say, I mean, I think it's a neat additional argument for self-ownership. Which is the neat additional argument, just this one there, the fulfilling contradiction? If you say, I don't own myself. Yes, I mean, then I don't see why that's true, because you claim that you're not owning, you're not claiming to own yourself, you don't claim to have a right to speak, you're just speaking. I'm not seeing what the contradiction is supposed to be. I know that's the claim, but I'm just not seeing how it's supposed to work. And then I'm just missing something I very frequently do. Jacques, I'm showing I can speak. Yes, that's exactly it. I'm showing I can speak. I'm not showing that I'm claiming the right to speak. And again, the basic step here, Jacques, is if you do something, are you claiming that you have a right to do it? That's what I'm saying is not logically required. I'm showing I can speak something. Let me see, where's another point? Matt said, yes, Matthew, that's right. I mean, just as magic, say, give an example. Of course, somebody could just, supposing you're going to a lecture, and if somebody goes into your car and drives off with it, that person isn't claiming he has the right to do that, he's just doing it. That would be exactly what the claim is. Oh, good. You see my argument. So, well, if you see my argument, then you're involved in preferred contradiction, but anyone can see my argument is you can only say you see my argument if in fact you didn't see my argument. Sorry about that when I couldn't resist that. I do think you have to be, I think when you first hear this preferred contradiction argument, it has a certain appeal to it. Sometimes it's very neat, it's shot with a neat argument, so you have to be careful about claiming more for an argument, trying to establish more for an argument. Now we're going to see what Jacques is going to suggest a counter control is ownership. Well, I mean, you could make that claim, but then why then wouldn't they have to say that a thief owns what he stole? And just control doesn't have to, because ownership is saying you ought to control something, not that you actually do control. That's the whole step that seems to me doubtful or invalid. I say the objectively possession is non-control. Oh, I mean, people could certainly come to accept such a rule, but they're not logically required to. Sometimes possession isn't ownership, it shouldn't be. Yes, but always stop with the yes. The thought is what's going to get us into trouble. Wouldn't it be funny if Hans and Stefan had me killed? It differentiates between first comers and late comers, yes. And then I'm sure that's right. But then, you could certainly hold a rule, and I would accept this myself, that the first person to homestead property should acquire it. But, I can speak so that I have original control of my body, right? But that, then you say latecomers couldn't trump that. Well, you're right, latecomers couldn't undo the fact that I was the original one to have control over my speaking, you're perfectly right. But that wouldn't follow from that, or at least if I'm not clear why it would, that the original owner, the original person to have control ought to be the one who has control. That would be a different claim. Now, it might very well be, I think it would be, that that would be a principle people would find it reasonable to accept, but I don't see they're involved in any logical contradiction if they deny that. I missed your question. Let me go back up and see if I can get it then. Let me see if I'm just trying to find it. Oh, here it is. Yes, let me just read it. Sorry, I missed it. Is that Michael? Is that right? How we object. Yes, and so your question is, well, if we don't accept self-ownership, when we have difficulty answering various left-wing philosophers, say, well, taxation is all right, so how do we refute that? Well, you see, I don't think we should reject self-ownership. I'm all in favor of that, and also principle of Lockean literature and Lockean appropriations. All I'm dealing with is whether this particular argument if you're involved in forming a contradiction, if you deny you own yourself or you claim that the first universe is only logically required, the only logically possible principle, I don't accept those arguments. It doesn't follow at all that I reject self-ownership or Lockean appropriation, perish the thought. So you see, I wouldn't be involved in any, it wouldn't be a problem for me in answering those people because I do accept self-ownership. I'm just saying that I don't think this is a particularly valid argument for self-ownership or for appropriation. I knew, maybe I should have left that point on. I knew this would get me into trouble. Now, someone said, what would Hans' response be after he punched me, after he punched me? I think Hans would probably give a response rather like the one Jock was suggesting, that he would think that in speaking you are implicitly claiming that you have a right to speak if you're the original speaker, and I'm just not seeing why that play with the rabbi. I think he probably would answer it this way. I've never discussed it with him. As I said, I like the interpretation of annotation ethics where you take it to be just things that would be reasonable in some looser sense to imagine people accepting if they were in a situation trying to come up with universalized rules based on respect for each other. And you see, one reason I take it that way, again, if you accept this kind of argument, this affirmative contradiction one, this doesn't require other people at all to be involved in the process of reaching agreement. You could just say it's just come up with this by yourself. Or maybe you would want to say you couldn't come up with it unless you were actually arguing with other people. I don't know. But actually, some jurists say you do things you. But I think by mixing, you know, Hume pointed that out, it's kind of a metaphor. It just means you're doing something to the land, and that the claim is, since you know that you're the first one to do it, then you should be the one to acquire it. See, the jurors get into trouble because they say, well, society really owns all land, but why should we accept that? Now, let's see, there's one. What do I think is justification based on self-ownership? Well, I just take it sort of somewhere along the lines of Murray Rothbard, it seems like an intuitively plausible principle that each person ought to have the decision over his own life, and say, well, isn't it obvious to us that slavery is a bad system? It seems like a generally accepted principle now that if there is something slave, if it's morally bad, I think we consistently think of what is involved in rejecting slavery when people come up with self-ownership. I don't think there's some kind of argument that shows where there's some sort of contradiction in rejecting self-ownership. I think it actually is a natural law, but I'm suggesting on argumentation ethics, it was like taking away, I was suggesting it would be one that people would agree on if they're starting from a point of view and respecting one another. You see, if you say, well, if they're starting from a point of view of respecting one another, then you would say, well, they really accept self-ownership as a presupposition for the argument in one way. Leslie points out child and mental health. Yes, well, I think generally the principle of patience can be applied to fully just to adults of sound mind. So then how we deal with each other, with children that come into philosophical ownership as they get older and incapacitated people would be, and we have to have those special ways of handling that. I don't think it would be directly deducible from self-ownership. And incidentally, one thing, it's one of my pet aversions I'll just mention. People who say that parents homestead children, that's really a deplorable view in my opinion. I don't say anyone suggesting it, but I mean, I've sometimes heard that's really an awful view to take. Locke clearly rejected that. Michael said, orientation ethics tries to set them straight with you. That's right. I mean, I think orientation ethics is trying to come up with a way of showing that we do own ourselves. And I think there is a way of taking orientation ethics that it does show that. And I just suggested this referring to contradiction argument doesn't do the job. So we don't want to have a bad argument that comes up with the right conclusion. John says Cohen and Joyce and Black Rose go. Yes, I thought the one who's really closest to Joyce, one we haven't talked about in this course of libertarian philosophy, a friend of mine, Kilian Steiner at University of Manchester, and he accepts libertarian self-ownership if he thinks we start off from equal, everyone has an equal claim to all the land and resources. So kind of a Georgist version of libertarianism. It's the only possible universe either. Well, there I want to know what is mean by possible, what do you mean logically possible? I wouldn't see why that's true, but you know, I want to see in more detail what the argument would be there. Well, there, if you want to avoid conflict, you have to, well, I think these are certainly, libertarian principles are certainly the most reasonable ones, and some principles people would agree on. And I want to, if that's what he's claiming, I would agree with that, as long as you don't say it's logically required. What is Rothbard's? Rothbard said basically, we consider the various possible options there. We have self-ownership, and certain people own others, and then we imagine some kind of something like each of us own parts of everyone else. And then if we just think about these systems, we'll see that the self-ownership principle is the most plausible of the three. How does this differ from argumentation? Well, it doesn't involve particularly an appeal to imagining people and what they would reasonably agree on. It just thinking, you can imagine us thinking of each person, imagine each person just thinking about this separately, coming up with a conclusion. It wouldn't involve some process of saying people would agree on these principles, and that would be the underlying basis for the way to be principles that people would reasonably agree on, although he probably said, but see, the basic point here is how is the causation going? If you say these are the right principles, we can show these right principles, so then people who want the right principles would agree on them, then you're really starting with the principles, say, well, just like why do we get everyone would agree that 2 plus 2 equals 4, because 2 plus 2 is 4. So really the agreement doesn't come into why the principle is true, but on the argumentation of it, what makes it true, what makes the principle true is that people agree with them. So that's the basic difference. Now one complication of this is that Rothbard was quite sympathetic to Hans's argument. He tended to accept this preferring contradiction argument that I was bringing into question. So he really accepted that. But you see, again, this preferring contradiction argument really isn't an appeal to agreement. So it isn't really that much of a, I think it's really different from argumentation ethics, although I'm not really clear on what relations between the firm contradiction is and the structural orientation of it. Now, which is Locke's position? Because I think he accepts argumentation ethics, but he thinks it's consistent with voluntary slavery, and I'm not sure exactly what his view of argumentation ethics is. I've had some discussion with it, but I don't really understand his view to it. Hillelstein, yes, that's right. Now, which is, Michael, which is utilitarian? No, the argument, natural rights argument certainly isn't utilitarian. It's just saying which, you imagine these alternatives, you say which is intuitively plausible, but the rejecting slavery, so it wouldn't be utilitarian argument. Oh, good. Yeah, yes. You say Hans and I had a similar view. Rothbard. We both knew Ray Rothbard very well, so it's not surprising that we come up with a similar response and what his view is. Michael, it isn't a utilitarian argument, really. It's just an appeal to our moral judgment. Yes, that's right. That's exactly what Murray would say. And yes, I don't think that differentiates Rothbard from argumentation. I would think that Rothbard is utilitarian. Yes, someone just as a strange person. Yes, it is the person who could have the television set. That's one of the reasons he was the strangest person I knew. Okay, well, I guess we're and one other reading by Conrad. So I'll just put one down here. I'll just put one down here that you might find helpful. I'll just put that. Yes, I think that would be one to look at. Does anybody else have any? Well, thank you, Matthew. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you, and I hope now it's September 15th. Oh, good. You're taking my economic reasoning. Well, that's very kind of you. I hope maybe by then Tom definitely has gotten rid of me, but if not, I hope I'll see you in my next course. Thanks very much, everybody. Okay, so hope to see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for coming to my course. Okay.